now we introduce models, techniques. Today we start solving them. So first, I want to do a brief review on harmonic oscillator path integral. So I have a Hamiltonian of coupled harmonic oscillators. I have some mass matrix, and I have a force constant matrix. This could represent phonons on a lattice or masses coupled to strings. Many times you see the mass matrix is diagonal with the same mass for all particles or different masses. Doesn't matter. This is a general analytical mechanics problem. When you want to write a Lagrangian, all you have to do is change the change the Hamiltonian by essentially adding a term that looks like pi qi dot minus h of p and q. You can easily verify that the equations of motions are the correct equations, because when you take dl d pi equal to zero, that's the Euler-Lagrange equation, you will get qi is equal to dh dpi, qi dot, sorry. That'll be functionally taking functional derivatives with respect to pi will give us this set of equations, and then there'll be the other set of equations, dl dqi equal to zero, which will give us the minus the derivative of the pi, so it'll be minus pi minus dh qi equal to zero. So these are the two Hamilton-Jacobi equations of motion for the I, and if we apply it to harmonic oscillators, we'll immediately get, when we take the first equation, we'll get the qi dot derivative of this h with respect to pi will be the mass term, so the mij inverse pj, sum over j, and pi dot is equal to minus Kij, Qj, sum over j. So you recognize, of course, these two equations. If you take a single particle, this will be P over m is equal to the velocity, and this will be the acceleration times the mass is equal to the minus the force constant times the displacement. So these two equations are particular to harmonic oscillators. Now, all this analytical mechanics helps us to identify the path integral of harmonic oscillators. The path integral of harmonic oscillators is essentially the evolution operator at time t between p0, q0, and p of t, q of t is simply dp dq from p0 and q0 to p of t, q of t, e to the I, the Lagrangian of p and q, integrated dt prime from 0 to t. So this is the action, integral of a Lagrangian, and this is the harmonic oscillator path integral. The harmonic oscillator path integral written in histories in phase space. There's the Feynman path integral that's given as a history only of Q of t, and it's second order in time. This Lagrangian is first order in time. It's just two different ways of writing path integrals, and you can be sure that when you take the saddle point approximation for this path integral, all you'll do is essentially take the derivative of this action with respect to P and Q. That will give you the Euler-Lagrange equations, which will be solved by histories that obey these classical equations of motion. So the saddle point of the path integral gives you the right frequencies. If you solve for harmonic oscillators, you'll get that there are normal modes. Normal modes would be the ones which I'll soon show you, will solve this equation of motion. And if you take those normal modes as independent harmonic oscillators, you will get the spectrum of the many on-harmonic oscillators. So how do you get the eigenmodes? Well, you essentially write the equation as follows. You write the Lagrangian in terms of P and Q matrix P and Q. There's a factor of a half in front. Here you put the matrix M to the minus 1. Here you put the matrix K. And notice there is a PQ dot, which is diagonal in index I, but it couples P to a derivative respective time of Q. So one could write this as d dt of PQ dot. So it's d dt, and then there is a delta ij, so I write it as a unit matrix. And here I'll have minus d dt, and I have a factor of a half. So what I'm using here is that PQ dot integral dt is the same as a half PQ dot minus P dot Q dt prime 0 to t. Why is that true? Because by integration by parts, I can make this term look exactly like that term. So it's just an anti-symmetrized way of writing this term. So this is just a more convenient way of writing the matrix. And what I want to do is find the solutions P and Q that solve this coupled differential equation. And that is done by a Fourier transform in time. So when I Fourier transform this in time, everything stays the same except dt becomes I omega. So I'll get P and Q times a matrix P and Q, which look like I omega M inverse K minus I omega. And what I want to find is P and Q of T, normal mode alpha, is going to be just one frequency, omega alpha T, P and Q at time 0. That's a normal mode. So a normal mode will be a mode that if I plug it in here, it'll make this matrix times the mode vanish. So essentially what I want to find is the solution of the determinant equation, determinant of m minus 1 I omega minus I omega k equal to 0. And I can play with this determinant to write it essentially as the determinant of omega squared, right? I omega times minus omega is omega squared minus m inverse k is equal to 0. So what I need to do is diagonalize m inverse k. So omega alpha squared are the eigenfrequencies of m minus 1k. And the eigenfunctions of m minus 1k are the normal modes p alpha, q alpha, are eigenvectors of m minus 1k. Okay, this is a very general way of solving coupled harmonic oscillators. Now, as you know in physics, the only system we know how to solve are coupled harmonic oscillators. And everything else that can be mapped to it. It's kind of an incorrect statement in general, but it's good to remember that we can't really go much away from harmonic oscillators when we want to really solve analytically complicated physical problems. So, in many cases, we take a complicated physical problem and find how to represent it approximately as coupled harmonic oscillators. Now, there could be many, many possibilities of finding this harmonic expansion. When you have a path integral, you automatically, when you have a saddle point, the next correction to the saddle point is going to be a Gaussian in the degrees of freedom. And a Gaussian is essentially coupled harmonic oscillators. So in every saddle point expansion that you will find, the next correction to the leading order in the saddle point is going to be harmonic oscillators. And the same we're going to do with spin systems. That's why I went to this harmonic oscillator review very rapidly, because what we want to do now is cast the problem of the Heisenberg ferromagnet and antiferromagnet. And in the tutorial, you'll have the XY antiferromagnet. And essentially, any magnetic, coupled magnetic system or coupled lattice system could be cast as an expansion where the lowest order terms are written in this form. So once we get into the form up there, H is equal to some coordinates P, some coordinates Q, coupled quadratically. Nonsense quadratically is very important here. There are second order in P and Q, and there's no third order terms. Then we can solve the problem exactly using this procedure. Questions? Yeah.
So I haven't really had time to analyze what's being written. So we need to solve that determinant equation, and I see that matrix appears on the left in the expression for the Lagrangian. Why is it that matrix?
Okay, so when you take a derivative with respect to P and Q, you'll get this matrix times P and Q. And if you want to set the derivative to zero to find what solutions you get, right, the solutions here are essentially where we take the derivative with respect to P and Q, you get zero. That's, if you want, the saddle point solution of the equation of motion. So just a way of writing the same equations we wrote before for quadratic. You see the two equations above? The two equations above are essentially a time derivative of a vector QP is equal to some matrix times PQ. Right? So that is essentially, for many degrees of freedom, an eigenvalue problem to find the equations of motion of harmonic oscillators. That's only for harmonic oscillators, of course, that finding the equations of motion is an eigenvalue problem. Okay? So that's the trick. That's the expression you need to get. So all you need to do, essentially, to solve the quadratic problem is cast the degrees of freedom in this form where you have m and k, and you have to take the eigenvectors of m inverse k. Okay? That's technically all you have to do. Of course, it becomes more complicated when you have many degrees of freedom coupled in many different ways. Just to write down these matrices requires some work, and then diagonalizing them in general, it's not a big deal. Computers do it now very, very rapidly. But you still have to do it, and then you find the normal modes and you find the frequencies. Now the question, what do you do with the frequencies and the normal modes? Well, you can now, based on the fact that these are harmonic oscillators, and you found the combinations of P and Qs that solve the equations of motion, you can cast the problem in terms of the normal modes, and then it becomes just free harmonic oscillators. So for free harmonic oscillators, we know what the partition function is. And we know what the energies are, and we know what the eigenfunctions are. So now, the energy eigenvalues are represented in terms of occupation numbers of these normal modes, and they're just sum over the normal modes. H bar, here comes quantum mechanics, omega, alpha are these frequencies we calculated, the number of times we occupy them plus a half. The eigenfunctions are also represented in terms of these occupation numbers, essentially bosonic Fock states, are simply harmonic oscillator wave functions of occupation n alpha. These are Hermite polynomials termed Gaussian, of the coordinate q alpha, which are the normal modes, product over alpha. And the partition function gives us a free energy, which is T, sum over the normal modes alpha, log sin chi hyperbolic omega alpha divided by 2T. Very simple. We have all the solutions. From this, we get all the thermodynamic properties we need. Entropy, specific heat, derivative with respect to all kinds of parameters will give us compressibility, pressure, anything we want out of the free energy. So these are the results we immediately get once you write things in terms of normal modes. Okay? So now we're back to spin coherent states. And how do we get the spin coherent state path integral to look like normal modes? And that's called spin wave theory. Okay. Spin wave theory is derived by writing the Lagrangian of, we have essentially our path integral was written in terms of d. Now I'm writing it as cos theta d phi. These are, as you remember, the 2 degrees of freedom that define d omega. And I'm neglecting here now the factors of 2s plus 1 divided by 4 pi. They're not so important for the discussion here, the overall normalization of the path integral. And then I have here an exponent. And inside I have integral 0 to t dt prime. And I have is cos, actually, 1 minus cos theta phi I dot. And then I have a minus, and I have here h, which depends on cos theta and phi of all the degrees of freedom. That's what we got last time. This is the spin coherent state path integral. I'm actually writing it in terms of an evolution operator. There's just I in front of everything. This is the Berry phase term. This is the Hamiltonian. Notice it doesn't look very far away from the phase-based path integral. If I identify P as S times cosine theta I, and identify QI as just phi I, that's an identification. Okay? So doing that, I need to take H and to write it in a quadratic form of the cos theta and phi in order for it to be like harmonic oscillator. Because this term here looks like S minus S times cos theta phi dot. Actually, I need here minus sign if I want to make it exactly the same. So this term here looks like pq dot I. It couples, and I'm having sum over I here. It couples the s cos theta, which is p, to phi dot, which is qi dot. Okay? So I get this minus h pq. Now, I need to choose essentially my coordinates such that this will be very close to a quadratic form. Yeah. Okay, what about the constant?
Well, S phi dot, right?
Yes. So there is a constant S phi dot integrate dt from 0 to t.
All right.
So this is a full integral of phi of t minus phi of 0.
Is that the total derivative?
Which could be 2n times pi. It's a constant. In the equations of motions, it falls out. But I specifically want to keep it for a little bit because this constant is going to make a lot of interesting physics in other phases, not the one I'm going to describe now, which is an ordered phase, but in a disordered phase, these constants are topological and they make a difference. And they make a difference, they are quantum mechanical effects, Aronoff-Bohm type effects, that one does not get in the spin wave theory, which is a harmonic expansion about an ordered phase. So I keep these, but they won't be used for the spin wave theory. So for the spin wave theory, these terms and these terms are important. And all I need to do now is decide in this path integral to choose my coordinates such that they describe small fluctuations about some particular configuration of spins, which will be the what's called putative order. What is a putative order? I have this integral over all cosine, theta, and all phi. So in principle, I'm summing up over spins over the whole unit sphere. But based on my prejudice, I think that the system wants to order. Now, how does it want to order? It wants to order to minimize H. Okay? So I'm assuming, and I'm emphasizing the word assuming, because that's something that has to be checked after the calculation. I'm assuming spins are ordered to minimize H. Minimizing H means minimizing the classical energy of the Hamiltonian. The classical energy has some minimum, and it may have many different minima, but I choose one particular minimum. And I expand cos theta and phi close to that minimum to second order. At the minimum, of course, there will be no linear term because by definition, the minimum is where all the linear terms vanish and I will only have a quadratic term and I'm keeping essentially the quadratic terms and they will give us a harmonic oscillator, small vibration, small fluctuation type Hamiltonian. And that's what we need to diagonalize in spin wave theory. So I'll give no examples now because I have to put in the Heisenberg Hamiltonian here, and I have to decide on what is its putative ground state, classical ground state, to expand around. Okay? So I explained my logic here, and now I'm doing the simplest problem, which is the Heisenberg ferromagnet. Okay? Something we haven't seen before. All it is the reason I'm showing you the ferromagnet, first of all, it's a simple model. And second, there's some interesting physics you learn by comparing the ferromagnet to the antiferromagnet. So the ferromagnet is minus j s squared, sum over ij, cos theta I, cos theta j, plus sine theta I, sine theta j, cos phi I minus phi j. Right? That's just omega dot omega written explicitly in cosine. And now, I'm assuming that omega I is very close to x plus in the theta phi direction, there will be a delta theta I and a delta phi I, which are small fluctuations. So what I'm assuming is that delta theta and delta phi are small. Let me draw it. This is x, which is the classical minimum of the energy. So if I just take it in the x direction, cos theta is 0, sine theta is 1, cos phi I minus phi j is 0, I get minus js squared for every bond. That's precisely the ferromagnetic, one of the ferromagnetic ground states. Of course, I can rotate this vector uniformly on the whole lattice, but if I'm picking this guy, then my fluctuations are characterized by this will be delta theta, and in the xy direction, this will be delta phi. So all I need to do is expand this about the x direction. So if I expand this about the x direction, sine theta is very close to 1. So this will be delta theta I, this will be delta theta j, sine theta will be 1 minus a half delta theta I squared. This will be 1 minus a half delta theta j squared. And this guy, again, if delta phi's are very small, then also the differences are supposed to be very small. This would be just 1 minus a half phi I minus phi j squared. So overall, if I collect the leading order term, it's the 1 times 1 times 1 times number of bonds, I get minus j s squared number of lattice sites times coordination number divided by 2. Coordination number divided by 2 is the number of bonds. That's the classical energy, classical ground state energy. So I'm expanding about this. And notice that I'll get a positive quadratic form here of delta theta and delta phi. And what will be the positive quadratic form? Well, it'll be written as the following way. There's factors of a half here for the diagonal terms. Yes.
Is that the, because if you expand sine to the second order, that would give you 1 minus 1 by 3 factor, theta minus theta by 3.
If you expand around 0.
The other way around.
If you expand the sine theta around 0, you're absolutely right. But you expand it around, you expand it around pi over 2. Theta is measured from, theta is, okay, so theta is pi over 2. Plus delta theta. So if I'm expanding it around pi over 2, it's like turning it into a cosine. Okay. So now I have this quadratic form. And how does it look like? Well, it looks like delta theta, and then there's delta phi, a matrix, and delta theta, delta phi. And of course, I want to identify, as we said before, cos theta times s with pi. So I'll do a transformation here. So pi is cos theta I times minus s. And for theta very close to pi, right? Cos theta becomes very, very small. So if I put this into here, I'll get that I'm delta theta is actually going to give me a negative contribution times minus s. It's s delta theta I. And phi I is just delta phi I. So identify p, sorry, that's q, qi. So identify P and Q with S delta theta and Q with delta phi. So I want to write it actually in terms of P and Q because that will make it look exactly like a harmonic oscillator. So let me write this quadratic form as PI, QI, PI, QI, and of course the matrices in between will be M minus 1 and K. Now let's look at these matrices M minus 1, K. Read them from this form. So M minus 1, IJ, is equal to These are sum of a bonds, and M is written in terms of site indices I and J. But we see that we only get contributions when I and J are nearest neighbor, separated by some vector eta. So I have M between I and J is sum over nearest neighbor eta. The coefficient in front of this whole business is JS squared. And I said I want a factor of a half in terms of all this. So I have JS squared. And here I have the sum of all nearest neighbor bonds, eta, delta. So for instance, here I have the delta ij appears with a minus sign, sums a minus sign. So I'll have delta with a plus sign, ij. That's from this guy. And then there's also terms connecting delta I to delta I plus eta. So there's, and it comes with a minus sign, I plus eta j. This is simply the matrix. It's a matrix with diagonals which are positive and off diagonals which are negatives, where the off diagonals connect site j to I plus eta, or I to I plus eta, and I'm summing over all the nearest neighbors. Want to see if I didn't miss factor of a half. I think I didn't. Yeah, that's okay. So what is K? K, ij, is precisely the same thing. It has a half phi I squared, a half phi j squared, and then phi I phi j, and phi j phi I with a relative minus sign. So again, it's the same matrix, but the only difference is, okay, I forgot to divide here by S squared because P was S times cosine theta, so this doesn't have the S squared. And this does have the S squared, so it has J S squared, sum over eta, delta ij minus delta I plus eta j. These are the force constant matrix and the mass matrix of the spin waves about the ferromagnetic state. And they're not written in a diagonal form, so I need to diagonalize them to find the eigennodes. But notice they're actually the same kind of a matrix except for different coefficient. And I can now diagonalize them. So diagonalizing them is done by a lattice Fourier transform. Notice that we already did this in the exercise on the tight binding model. We looked at this part. The off-diagonal coupling of I to its nearest neighbor is exactly the form that we had in the tight binding model. And we've diagonalized it by a Fourier transform in K space. And what did we get? We got the gamma K, the function to the sum of a cosine kx, cosine ky. So Fourier transform of M becomes M of K, which is simply J times number of nearest neighbors, one, that's the Fourier transform of one, minus gamma K. And K of K is JS squared Z 1 minus gamma K. So this is M inverse. So omega K is simply J squared. This is omega K squared. J squared Z squared S squared times 1 minus gamma K squared. Or if I want just the dispersion, omega K is 1 minus gamma K times J, S, Z. These are the spin waves dispersion of a ferromagnet. Let me raise this. I'll draw it for you. So, ferromagnet, this is K, I'm just drawing it in one dimension. Cosine 1 minus gamma k looks like this function. At k equal to 0, it vanishes because gamma k is equal to 1. At k equal to pi, gamma k is equal to minus 1. So 1 minus gamma k becomes 2. So this is 2 times jsz. Gamma k, let's say in general, is 1 over d cosine kx plus cosine ky, and so on. So it's 1 over d times d minus a half kx squared plus ky squared plus da da da. So in general, it's 1 minus 1 over 2d times k absolute value squared plus order k to the fourth. So the behavior of, this is gamma k. So 1 minus gamma k times jsz, which is omega k, is simply jsz. 1 will cancel this 1, and then I'll have, just a second. No, something is wrong. Okay, I have here a k squared. Just a minute, let me just check the factor of z here. Yeah, I think. One over 2D, so it's JSK. Okay, so this is something that goes omega K goes like some JS times K squared. Okay, that's what we learned from the ferromagnet. Yeah.
A few questions. One is, I see that we have there an equation, two equations that involve gamma k and show what it is, but what is it physically?
Spin waves?
So gamma k is solution to the problem?
Yes, this is the spin wave dispersion. These are the frequencies of the spin fluctuations about the ferromagnetic state. The spin fluctuations are quantized like harmonic oscillators. Okay? They have small fluctuations, and there's a frequency as a function of k. This is called dispersion. In waves in general, one important quantity that we need to get is the frequency versus wavelength. Okay, you're probably familiar with waves. Those of you who like surfing, for instance, know that what is sea waves dispersion? Somebody knows? Shallow water? Not enough of you. Yeah.
Would you mind reading how the gamma k coming when you do the first?
Gamma k is the Fourier transform of the tight binding nearest neighbor lattice model, which is exactly delta of I plus eta j, that matrix. If I write the matrix in one dimension, it's very simple. Gamma k is the matrix which looks like this, with periodic boundary conditions. Diagonalizing this matrix will give you this function, gamma k. Okay, this is the tight binding matrix, and the Fourier transform will make it look like gamma of k equals 0, gamma of k equals 2 pi over n, up to gamma of k equal to 2 pi. So And I missed it here, factor of four, because it's... So gamma k is the Fourier transform of the tight binding matrices. In two dimensions, I have also coupling between I and I plus eta in the y direction. So I have a matrix which is less sparse than this guy in three dimensions again. But we know how to diagonalize these matrices very easily, and they give us this function gamma k that I showed you before. Okay? Yes?
And that symbol over there, FMI?
FM colon.
And FM stands for?
Ferromagnetic.
And
AFM, anti-ferromagnetic.
Okay. And then the Hamiltonian, so you mentioned that the products of trig functions that involve angles associated with different spins denotes coupling, but why does the whole Hamiltonian have that one?
I'm expanding the Hamiltonian about a particular spin direction to second order in the fluctuations. Okay?
Well, the original expression for Hamiltonian...
The original expression is written there in terms of cosines and sines.
Yes.
The second order is written in terms of these deltas.
Yeah, and then, so I meant, why does the original
Yeah, there's no coupling between, okay. What I'm saying is that this is a particular expansion about a particular direction, but in general, I can always expand a Hamiltonian in terms of it, around its minimum to second order in the fluctuations. When I do that, I'll get the small fluctuation Hamiltonian, exactly like in coupled masses and springs. When you take coupled masses and spring, you find the equilibrium ground state, and then you do small fluctuations, and you get a quadratic harmonic oscillator. Very general in physics, okay? So this is another example.
I was actually not asking about the expansion, but about the original Hamiltonian.
The ferromagnetic Hamiltonian? That was the Heisenberg. We know that already, right? This Hamiltonian written up there is what I wrote last lecture as the Heisenberg model in spin coherent state basis. So it's, okay, I've introduced nothing new here except solve for the small fluctuations. But another thing I want to solve is the wave functions or the modes themselves. There are modes associated with these dispersions, and I want to just give you a principle how it looks like. So the modes are delta cos, or like delta theta I, delta phi I, alpha, okay. This is just plane waves. So this is just plane waves, and you can see from the way that the equations of motion go that one depends on the derivative of the other. So if I have two coordinates, x and y, let's say, because they're all this, what they're really describing is a spin fluctuating in the z. This is my x direction, and this is my y direction. So it's in the zy plane, I have circles. This direction is delta theta. This direction, or this direction in the other direction, is delta phi. And I have a coupled motion of delta theta and delta phi with a frequency omega k. Now, k is the change of the phase of the oscillation as a function of space, right? So if I take, for instance, wavelength k is equal to 2 pi divided by lambda, so this is lambda, then I have here the spin sitting here, and then it's sitting here, and then it's sitting here, and then it's sitting here, and back here. So the position on this circle will depend on space according to the wave vector k, and it will come back to itself after distance lambda, and all the spins are oscillating in the same chirality. They're all precessing. So remember when we solved the single spin in the magnetic field, it precessed in a particular direction according to the right-hand rule. Here they're all precessing, but not exactly with the same phase because it has some spatial dependence. And as you can see, the precession is all with the same frequency, omega k. The precession frequency depends on this wavelength. That's the dispersion. But by the way, C waves have a dispersion of omega goes like square root of k. That's for anybody interested. OK, so I'll erase it so you won't confuse the spin waves. Dispersion tells us about how information moves on the lattice. And I want to count now the number of modes I have. A ferromagnetic system has one dispersion. And if I look at where the dispersion has the lowest frequency, it's only one point in the Brillouin zone, k equals 0. So I have one low-lying, this is a low-lying mode. And from now on, we'll call it a Goldstone mode. Okay? So a Goldstone mode is a small fluctuation mode about an ordered phase. We assumed order, right? Everything underlying here is assuming order. Now we say around that order, the system will produce a low energy mode. In field theory, it's called massless mode. A single one, which is called the Goldstone mode. And that Goldstone mode has a dispersion that goes like k squared to the frequency. This is all I want to talk about the ferromagnet. Yes?
So a few questions. In the expression for omega k,
yes.
You have j as a set, and then there's no set. So why is that equal
to because d? It canceled the one over d from the definition.
So why is that equal to d?
What?
Why is it?
What?
So d is dimensional.
D is, right.
Why is
these dimensions and there's a connection between D and Z. I took the square lattice here, right? So two dimensions, coordination four.
Yeah. So it only depends. So
that's why it worked
out. Only for square lattice.
That's the square lattice, yes. Square lattice.
Okay.
By the way, this result, modulo the coefficient, is general for all lattices. Also the triangular lattice, honeycomb. I just did it for the square.
And yeah. Also, so k is?
K is the coefficients of the phi.
It's just a label, right?
No, it's not just a label. I want to write it as harmonic oscillators, and harmonic oscillators have mass and force constants. And
yeah. I mean the k on omega k.
K is momentum, because I diagonalized this matrix using Fourier transform, and my eigen functions are labeled by k.
Sure, but B was already momentum. So.
What? Yeah. No. Don't confuse. Sorry. Lattice momentum.
Okay.
There's the canonical momentum inside the path integral, and then there's now on the lattice wave vector, which I also use the word momentum for.
Just
two different things.
How does K depend on P and Q? How does the Fourier transform explicitly look?
Okay. P and Q are the coordinates and momenta of the harmonic oscillators.
Yes.
Now, if you're interested in this, you don't care about P and Q, you care about eigenvalues.
Yes.
That comes out from the determinant, right? Yes. From diagonalizing M inverse K.
Yes.
You don't use these to diagonalize it. You use only this matrix. But if you want to go back to modes, to describing actual motion of spins, then you go back to P and Q, and then you get this precession. So then it becomes valuable to talk about P and Q, right?
Sure, but how does Fourier transform look? What do you write down when you want to do?
No, I'm not Fourier transforming P and Q here. I mean, I'm Fourier transforming the matrix. See, that's the matrix I was diagonalizing, right? This guy diagonalized. Okay? So I understand that some of you haven't seen much condensed matter, but in condensed matter, you always diagonalize the lattices in Fourier transforms. Unless it's disordered, and then you have some other problems. But if it's a translational invariant problem, you always will see Fourier transforms as your diagonalization procedure. Okay, so it's automatically that we expect every eigenmode to be labeled by k. So now we're ready to do the antiferromagnet, which is very similar but has quite different physics. So the antiferromagnet on a bipartite lattice to make life simple. Actually, I could use this. The antiferromagnet has a Hamiltonian with a positive J, otherwise looks the same. This Hamiltonian wants to keep the spins anti-parallel. So I'm going to assume a bipartite lattice, but everything I say also follows for any lattice, as long as I know the ground state. And a bipartite lattice, I can pick the ground state to look like this. So I will assume theta I and phi I getting two different values. Pi over 2, 0 on sublattice A, and pi on sublattice B. This is theta and phi. This is exactly this kind of a x minus x oscillation. This minimizes this Hamiltonian and gives us a classical energy with the number of bonds, z over 2, coordination number divided by 2 is the number of bonds, times js squared, with a minus sign. That energy, by the way, is not a great energy for the Heisenberg antiferromagnetic, quantum Heisenberg antiferromagnet, because it's a classical variational estimate, and variational estimates are always larger than the true ground state. But in our expansion, this is the leading order term, and then we have to calculate the extra contributions. So my Hamiltonian is written as the classical energy plus, and now I need to expand exactly the same way as I did there, the cosine theta and the phi, but now I'm expanding it around these minima instead of the minima I had before. So, okay, so let me actually do it slowly. So this is the classical energy. So my Hamiltonian is written as plus js squared sum over ij cos theta I cos theta j plus sine theta I sine theta j cos phi I minus phi j. And I'll do the substitutions of delta theta and delta phi as follows. I'll write this as, again, I'm expanding around theta over 2, so cos theta becomes delta theta I delta theta j. Sine, again, is expanded around, in this case, 1 minus a half delta theta I squared, 1 minus a half delta theta j squared, exactly like the ferromagnet. But notice what happens here. Here, phi I and phi j live on different sublattices. One of them is shifted by phi. So I get, this is cosine of delta phi I minus delta phi j minus pi. Right? Because I have this shift of pi in my phi between this sublattice and this sublattice. So this, what we will do to a cosine is just flip the sign. So what I get here is an overall minus sign. And then I get 1 minus a half phi I minus phi j squared. Now, I'm happy with this minus sign because I want to get the classical energy. This is plus js squared, and the ones here will be multiplied by minus to give me a total negative energy. That's the classical antiferromagnet. So this made sure that I'll get the classical energy out of it. And then I have to expand. And notice in the quadratic expansion, I'll get the delta theta I with a minus sign times a minus sign, so it'll be plus. And here again, the phi I minus phi j squared minus sign times a minus sign will be plus. So all my fluctuations will have a positive force constant and a positive matrix, which is makes it stable. So all I need to do now is write this exactly like I did with the P and Q. So I have a minus j s squared n times z over 2 classical energy plus, and then I'll have a pi qi matrix m minus 1 k pi qi. And all I need is just right now m minus 1 and k, and I'll see that they are not the same exactly as the ferromagnet. Why? K is actually the same. So k, the force constant, is j s squared times sum over eta. This is kij. And then I'll have a delta ij minus delta I plus eta j. That's the force constant matrix I get from phi I minus phi j squared. This guy. Okay? And of course, I forgot the half in front. Yeah. M, on the other hand, is j times sum over eta. Now, just look carefully about the coefficients. Here, okay, I have a positive coefficient. And here, I also have a positive coefficient. So what I'll get here is delta I j plus delta I plus eta j instead of minus like in the K matrix. This is M inverse. So all the change between the ferro and the antiferromagnet is this relative sign has shifted in the mass part of the quadratic form. So now we're ready to do the Fourier transform and get the dispersion. They're very simple. Omega k squared is just, okay, first I'll do the Fourier transform, then I'll. Right, so Fourier transform of k stays the same. So M Fourier transform will give me the eigenvalues, which is j s squared, sorry, without the s. No, let me do k first. K is j s squared z, and then 1 minus gamma k, same as before. M, on the other hand, inverse, is j z 1 plus gamma k. So my frequencies, omega k squared, is going to be j s squared z squared 1 minus gamma k squared, or omega k is equal to j s z 1 minus gamma k squared square root. How does it look like? In one dimension, we notice this guy vanishes in two places. One at k equals 0, and the other place is at k equals pi, where this becomes minus 1, but minus 1 squared is 1, so 1 minus 1 is 0, so we get this dispersion. Now, in higher dimensions, it has to be pi pi. The vector pi, pi, pi as much as the dimensions go. Okay. What are the dispersions close to zero, the Goldstone modes? The two Goldstone modes here, both of them have a dispersion that I will get by expanding this for small k. So expanding gamma k to small k, we saw, gives me 1 minus 1 over 2d k squared. So when I take 1 minus gamma k squared, so I'll have the cross term 1 over 2 dk squared. So this will be jsz. And then I'll have a square root. Okay, and then I'll have a k absolute value times 1 over square root of d. I think I'm right. Let me see. Js square root of d. So I think it's... and of course, yeah. So overall, the... This is for k close to 0. This dispersion is linear. Omega goes like absolute value of k. The coefficient of a linear dispersion is called velocity, c. C is spin wave velocity. There's a characteristic velocity scale that comes out of this. Depends on the magnetic energy, the size of the spin, dimensionality, and so on. And the omega k goes like c times k. Reminds us of light, reminds us of sound, reminds us of relativistic field theory. Right? Because k and omega both have the same power. Yes? Question?
Sorry, why is that not a square root of j? Square root is to get omega.
Because it was j squared, right? This times that gave us j squared, s squared, z squared, and then I took the square root to get omega k.
So there should be a square of j.
Here?
1 less 2.
This was wrong. Sorry.
Sorry.
Omega k squared is m to the inverse k. Right? So j squared, sz, s squared, z squared. Yeah, that's right. Sorry. OK. So notice the antiferromagnet is different than the ferromagnet. Two things are different. One. Antiferromagnet, two Goldstones, and relativistic. Omega goes like k. Okay? Now, one would like to ask, how do the modes look like? Well, the modes, if I draw them, look like circles, exactly like before, where the spins are circulating on the ZY plane. They're all circulating in the same direction. They have to circulate in the same direction relative to their sign. So here it will circulate this way, and here it will circulate this way. Am I right? Don't want to make. No, they're all circulating in this. No, just a second. I'm sure I knew this thing. Yeah, they're opposite direction. So let's look at the mode. Okay, so think about this mode where these two spins are sitting here and coinciding at t equals 0. And then one of them moves this way, and another one of them moves this way. And they coincide again when it's half a period. And then they come back to this place. How does their combined spin look like? Well, when they start this way, it's essentially, if you add the two spins up, it will give you some kind of a a vector this way. And when they're here, it'll give you a vector going this way. So there'll be if you want, a sum of spins going up and down along this plane. And when they're on both sides of the circle, they're actually, the sum will cancel and it'll be exactly at zero. So there'll be this canting vector going up and down. And on this, and if you look at the difference between the two spins, like the this spin minus that spin, the difference is going to be, in one case, in this case, it's going to be in the plane. That's the difference. And when it's going to be, the two spins are in the plane, the difference is actually going to lie in the yz plane, in the y direction. So this is s omega 1 plus omega 2. And omega 1 minus omega 2 is going to do a fluctuation. This is the y direction. It's going to do a fluctuation in the plane. That's assuming a uniform k equals 0 spin fluctuation. I'm just parameterizing it in terms of sum and differences of the spins. So as you can see, the difference actually is a vector that fluctuates in the plane. What happens at k equal pi? At k equal pi, this guy is going to be on the bottom because there's a difference of pi in the phase between this guy and that guy. That's the meaning of k equal pi. There's a pi phase shift on every lattice site. So if this guy is here, then you can see that the difference between them is going to be fluctuating at k equal pi, omega 1 minus omega 2 is going to fluctuate like this in the zx plane. So the difference between this mode and this mode is the polarization of the difference between the two spins. This is in plane. Okay, let's call it, I'll give you this. The name of the plane is xy plane. And this is, and it's the same as that, it's the xz plane. And these are the fluctuations of omega 1, omega a, sublattice A, minus omega sublattice B. Okay, so what am I doing here? I'm trying to describe the fluctuations at k equals 0 and pi in terms of a new object, which is the difference between the spin directions of sublattice A and B. The difference between sublattice A and sublattice B is actually what's called the order parameter of the antiferromagnet. It's the object that acquires a large number when the system is ordered antiferromagnetically. Because if I ask what is the average spin direction, it's 0 in the antiferromagnet. But if I ask what is the average difference between sublattice A and sublattice B, that's a vector which we will call the Niel vector, 2 times the Niel vector. And that is the important degree of freedom we identified in the antiferromagnet for the fluctuations. The two Goldstone modes describe a Niel vector fluctuating in the plane and a Niel vector fluctuating in the xz direction. So the two modes that we get here have decoupled, because this mode and this mode are completely independent. They can fluctuate separately. They're just two different modes of a linear problem. And they describe motion in the plane, motion in the xz and in the xy. The two directions that one expects to find small fluctuations, right? When you have a broken symmetry on the sphere in a rotationally invariant problem. So if this is my n vector that lives on the sphere, it has two transverse directions that can fluctuate, which we identified with the k equals 0 and k equals phi directions. Okay? So, for those of you who studied a little bit of field theory or a little bit of statistical mechanics, you know that in relativistic field theory, people count the number of low-lying modes very simply. They say, I have an order parameter. It breaks a certain symmetry. Let's look at how many directions I can move the order parameter to restore the symmetry. So if I decide the order parameter is pointing in the x direction, I broke the rotational symmetry. There's two directions I could fluctuate it, one in the longitudinal, one in the transverse. Two modes, I should get two Goldstones. And that exactly happens in the antiferromagnet. But we go back to the ferromagnet, it doesn't happen there. I broke symmetry of the spin on the sphere, but I have only one mode. And the reason is the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model is a strange anomaly among quantum models. It has non-relativistic dynamics, and it has too low number of Goldstone modes, and the modes themselves don't disperse linearly. So the ferromagnet is a case where relativistic field theory doesn't work, but the antiferromagnet seems to be agreeing with theorems coming from relativistic field theory. Okay, so these are the things I just want to comment now. And the other thing we can do is we can evaluate using these spin wave dispersions and also information about the modes, what actually are the quantum fluctuations doing to us in terms of changing the model from the classical limit to the quantum Heisenberg model. Because what we did so far is that we have a classical ground state and it fluctuates. Think of harmonic oscillators. What is the difference between a quantum harmonic oscillator and a classical one? It's the zero-point motion, right? So if I have a classical harmonic oscillator, it's essentially a harmonic oscillator with infinite mass. Or if I want to take h bar to 0, that's another way of doing it. Then classical harmonic oscillator will sit at t equals 0 with its mass at the bottom. A quantum harmonic oscillator will have certain finite energy, half h bar omega 0, and it will have a wave function, Gaussian wave function, with delta x squared not equal to 0. Okay, so let us remind ourselves from results from quantum mechanics 101, I don't know what you call it. Delta x squared in a quantum harmonic oscillator is equal to h bar divided by m omega, right? And what is delta p squared? Is h bar times m omega. Okay. This exactly holds for one harmonic oscillator and for many harmonic oscillators. All you need to do there is to write these as matrices for many harmonic oscillators. And what you evaluate there is the normal modes different fluctuations. So for a normal mode calculation, delta x squared is h bar is equal to 1 in our case. It's m inverse. And then omega is k m inverse, and it's all of it is inverse to the power half. So this simply becomes m times k to the power minus a half.
Where is this coming from?
This is okay, what I wrote here is matrices, but they're all essentially numbers.
But where's it coming from?
Right? This is omega squared minus a half is 1 over omega, 1 over m, 1 over m omega. Just writing it as matrices. What essentially I could write here is actually 1 over m of k omega k, right? Just made it more difficult by writing it as matrices. But delta p k squared is m of k omega k. Okay, now we solve for m of k, omega k, k of k. We solve for all that for the antiferromagnet. So let's write now the following expression. What is delta theta squared of k? Well, delta theta squared of k is essentially delta p of k squared divided by s squared, right? So it will be given by m of k, so it'll be given by 1 plus gamma k, and omega k is, just a second, no, 1 minus gamma k is minus 1, so it's, sorry, I'll write it this way. Omega k is 1 minus gamma k squared, a half, and I divide that by 1 plus gamma k. And all the coefficients that appear in m and omega divided by s squared just canceled out. I get a pure number out of this, as I should. It's just an angle. So I get this form, which could be simply written as 1 minus gamma k divided by 1 plus gamma k to the square root. What is delta phi squared? Delta phi k squared is equal to 1 over mk omega k, so it, 1 over mk is 1 plus gamma k divided by square root of 1 minus gamma k squared, which again could be written simply as 1 plus gamma k divided by 1 minus gamma k to the half. Okay, now I want to know what is the size of the fluctuation of the vector delta omega, simply delta theta k squared plus delta phi k squared. It's equal to the sum of this and that, 1 minus gamma k, 1 plus gamma k to the half, plus 1 plus gamma k, 1 minus gamma k to the half. We write the common denominator, which is this times that, so it's 1 minus gamma k squared to the half. And then we get this squared plus that squared, which is 1 minus gamma k plus 1 plus gamma k, and just get 2. Okay. Now I can ask the question, if I want to evaluate delta omega I on a particular site squared, I'll have to take delta omega, this is momentum k, and write it as 1 over n sum over k 2 divided by 1 minus gamma k squared. That'll be the sum of delta omega at momentum k squared. That's how I go to real space. I just take this sum in k space, it's equal to the sum in real space, divide by n to get the average fluctuation at position I. So I need to do this calculation. It's a simple integral. I forgot here the factor. Okay. Now, in principle, you can do this integral exactly in square lattices, or you can do it numerically on any lattice you want. But what I want to show you is some interesting effects that this integral gives you. First of all, we see that it's not zero. The fact it's not zero means spins are fluctuating in the ground state. They're not precisely pointing in the classical direction. They're doing a zero-point motion with the semi-classical description of these precessions. So they have some average fluctuation. This average fluctuation in terms of angles is of order 1. In other words, there's no factors of s here. It's just a number, a pure number. I don't know, 20 degrees fluctuation. Fine? No. Now I want to say, What is that? Okay, how is that number related to a physical quantity like what's called staggered magnetization? Staggered magnetization is the other parameter, which is essentially M staggered, which is equal to M0, which is a half, plus delta omega, delta omega squared times S square root. Minus a half delta omega squared times S. So if I multiply, I'm wrong here. This is S. Okay, that's a factor of S wrong. S minus, and then there will be this delta omega times S. Okay, that I was wrong there. So it will be delta omega squared times delta omega squared times S. This will be my staggered magnetization. Why? Because I have here size of the classical spin is S. My fluctuation direction is delta omega squared. But since I'm looking at this magnitude, it'll be delta omega squared times half delta omega squared times S will be my distance here of delta M. So delta M is a half delta omega squared times S. Okay. Now here, I said before this had no factor of S. I was wrong. There is a factor of S here. Let me find it. The reason was that between the mass and the force constants, I had a factor of S. The mass and the force constant, remember, one of them goes like JS squared, one of them goes like JS. So between them, they have a factor of S. So I'm kind of adding it by hand here. So this is gamma 1 over S. Okay, so once I do that, I'll see that delta omega squared times S is a number of order 1. That's what I wanted to say. But I'm doing an expansion for large S, essentially. So there'll be a term of order S, a term of order 1, and then the terms that I didn't calculate coming from cubic terms in the expansion will be of order 1 over S, and so on. I just want to see what is this number, delta M. It's an integral that I can easily do if I look at its singularity properties. Yes?
Have you been saying staggered magnetization?
Yes.
Why staggered?
Because the magnetization as a whole is zero in the antiferromagnet. What is not zero is the magnetization on sublattice A minus the magnetization on sublattice B. That's called staggered. Okay, it's an other parameter that I defined for the antiferromagnet. Okay, so now I want to do this integral, and that will be the end. This integral is quite simple to see if it diverges or not in different cases. So, in d equal to 1, I have delta m scales like integral dk times 1 over c times k. This integral here is divergent in both lower and upper bounds, but the lower bound is the most dangerous one. The upper bound is the Brillouin zone, 2 pi over a. A is lattice constant. That's finite. That's the ultraviolet cutoff. On the other hand, if I don't put here, if I take this all the way to k equals 0, I have a problem, because if I put here some lambda, this goes like log of lambda. And as lambda goes to 0, or minus log lambda, as lambda goes to 0, this integral diverges logarithmically. And you have to take lambda to 0 if you want to do the full sum. So we have a problem that in one dimension, delta m is actually infinite. If delta m is infinite, then my original assumption that there's some long-range order in the spin direction that I'm expanding small fluctuations about breaks down. I made a bad assumption. That's why I emphasized at the beginning, that assumption should be checked. We checked it now, and we saw it was a bad assumption. Spin wave theory fails. This is a very important and good property of spin wave theory that you can check when it fails. You check it self-consistently. You find that fluctuations are too large. Don't start with assuming long-range order. D equal to 2, the integral delta m is dk over 2 pi cube, 0 to Brillouin zone, k Brillouin zone, let's say. There's a k, and there's defining by k. So at least in the low end of the spectrum, this is actually finite. So this is less than infinity. Question is, how much less than infinity? Because what I want is S minus delta M still to be larger than zero in order for us to make sense that spin wave theory works. So what is delta M for particular models? That depends on the exact dispersion and the coordination and nearest neighbor interactions and a lot of other stuff. All I can tell you now is that the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model on the square lattice, nearest neighbor, has the property that delta M is equal to 0.2. So S is equal to half, 1, 3 halves, no matter what S I take, delta M is 0.2. So we see that for spin 1, 3 halves, 0.2 is a small correction. Spin wave theory is excellent. For half, it's already 0.5 to 0.2 becomes already sizable. 40% fluctuations for spin a half. Can we trust spin wave theory or not? Well, you don't know unless you do other checks. But it turns out that when people calculate numerically the order parameter m, numerical, it's really s minus 0.2 to, I don't know, like 3 digits. It's not exactly 0.2 something, but the spin wave theory is very close to the numerical, even though we are in the regime where 40% of the moment is fluctuating. So we learn a lesson here, that S being a half is not necessarily a small number in the sense of the applicability of the asymptotic expansion. But the asymptotic expansion seems to work well to give you the numerical results to high accuracy for spin a half Heisenberg antiferromagnet. For other problems, that's a different story. If you take a triangular lattice, or you take a Kagome lattice or frustrated lattice, spin wave theory gives you numbers that for spin 1 and 3 halves are excellent, but for spin a half start to become completely wrong. Because if delta M was slightly larger, let's say of order 0.5, then there's no justification to use spin wave theory. People try to use spin wave theory with some modifications, even for small spin, but they're getting into very thin ice there. So what we learn from this is that there is essentially, if you want, on the axis of spin, there's expected in D equal 2 a point where spin wave theory works, delta M much, much smaller than S, and where spin wave theory fails. Now, if it fails, does it mean you have a different phase? Not necessarily, but most commonly, yes. Once spin wave theory failed, in this case, you cannot really trust a nil ground state, and the system might have even no magnetic order at all. It might be what's called a quantum paramagnet, or more modern names for it is a quantum spin liquid. Spin liquid in a sense of the melting of the force constant matrix. So the analogy we did is very good. We did an analogy between a solid, which is vibrating springs, masses on springs, and spin waves. And we see that if the springs are vibrating so much that it destroys the solid, then you think of the system as a liquid. A liquid has no force constant matrix anymore, and of course no long-range positional order. And there's an analogy between melting of a solid to melting of a antiferromagnet. Okay? So a quantum spin liquid is expected in antiferromagnets when the spin size is small and when the Hamiltonian is complicated enough. And I didn't explain how to complicate the Hamiltonian, but in general, add more neighbor interactions, redo the calculation we did today, and find where you expect this transition to happen. So this is the message we learned from spin wave theory of antiferromagnet. What we're going to do next is analyze the antiferromagnet in terms of field theory. And this is where I'll introduce a continuum limit of the lattice model. And we'll see how the field theory tells us much more about correlations than we get by simple spin wave.